It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome, everybody, to the Untold Story podcast. This week, I am delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague, Lucas Tomlinson. He is just back from another tour of duty, you might say, in Kyiv, where he has been covering the situation that's unfolding in Ukraine. Lucas, it's great to have you back in the States and great to have you back on the Untold Story.
Martha, always great to join you.
You know, just remind everybody, Lucas, a little bit of your background so they know where you're coming from when you cover this kind of story, which deals with this intense war that's going on.
Well, sure, Martha. I'm a Naval Academy graduate. I served as an officer in the U.S. Navy for 6 years, and that includes a couple deployments aboard a warship to Europe, to South America, doing counter-drug ops. And I later did a tour in Afghanistan with a human terrain team on the ground with the Army, actually, 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division in 2011. That was the height of President Obama's surge when there was about 100,000 troops on the ground. And the fighting arguably was some of the fiercest of the wars because of the amount of American troops on the ground. So that's my military background, and that's what I brought to Fox when I was hired a decade ago.
Yeah, and you've worked at the Pentagon for a long time and been a war correspondent for us as well. You were in Ukraine early on in the war. And is this your second or third time that you have been over there?
It was my second.
So tell me a little bit about, you were just there for a few weeks and now you're back. And as I said, you were there in the beginning of the war when we, you know, lost a colleague, Pierre, and a couple of colleagues, Sasha as well, who was doing some work with us. That was such an intense period in this war. And I think Americans were following it so much more closely than they are now. So I wanted to bring you on and talk to you about the difference between what you saw then and what you see now. And a straightforward assessment of who's winning and who's losing there right now.
Well, that's right, Martha. I mean, clearly when Russian forces invaded Ukraine, it was war that the world had not seen, especially on the European continent since World War II. You know, people are not used to divisions of tanks, armor, personnel carriers, thousands of short-range ballistic missiles being launched, fighter jets. In fact, you know, the U.S. was always the big guy, whereas now in a war where the U.S. is supporting, you might argue, the little guy. So here are the Russian forces everybody thought would just roll into Kyiv after a few days. We've heard about that. It's obviously well documented. U.S. intelligence, they knew the Russians were going to invade. They thought the country would topple pretty quickly, and that didn't happen. However, Martha, when I went back to Ukraine, one of the goals I had was there's been a lot of cheerleading back home. In the U.S., you know, billions in weaponry given to the Ukrainians. In fact, just before getting on the phone with you just now, the Biden administration announced another $1 billion in American weapons were going to the Ukrainians. However, it's pretty significant that in the past month, the front lines in the war really haven't changed much since Russian forces took the Luhansk region. And shortly thereafter, the U.S. military's top officer, General Mark Milley, when he was asked, is the entire Donbass, the entire eastern portion of Ukraine going to fall? He said, not yet, which took some reporters back. And next thing you know, I'm in Ukraine wanting to see what this war looks like, because you're right, it has fallen out of the headlines, and for good reason. Of course, you know, Americans are suffering from, you know, record high inflation, high gas prices. You know, there's just a lot going on back home, whereas the war, it's trailed off a bit because you don't see the banner headlines in major newspapers, even at our own network. You don't see, you know, segments from Ukraine at the top of the rundown, top of the hour. And for good reason, the war, some officials would say, has ground to a stalemate. But it is significant to note that Russia controls more territory in Ukraine now than they did pre-invasion. So while they didn't take Kyiv, and that's great, most people would agree. The problem is Russia still controls over 20% of Ukraine, an area about the size of Mississippi. And that's not good news for the Ukrainians, who are, frankly, still struggling to prevent the Russians from taking more territory. We just saw the Russians announce they want to annex more territory in southern Ukraine. That's potentially bad news because, you know, you'd have Russia, you know, claiming you've seen what happens when they annex Crimea. After a number of years, it almost became de facto Russian-held territory. Now, the Ukrainians, the officials I spoke to on the ground in Kyiv, say the goal remains to not just get Russian forces back to pre-February 24th borders. They want to go all the way back pre-2014. In fact, go back to 1991. Of course, that's when Ukraine declared its independence during the coup attempt on, at the time, President Gorbachev. We don't have to go that far here. This isn't the History Channel. But that's what Ukrainians want, to go back to 1991 borders. But right now, Martha, there is no sign that the Ukrainians have the ability to recapture a significant amount of Russian-held territory. And that's not good news.
So where do you see this heading? Because, you know, you go back to those early days, and I remember the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, his early estimation was that Kyiv would fall in a few days. So
that's right.
Now he's saying, you know, Luhansk, not yet in terms of falling into Russian hands. And you can easily go through, you know, headlines in morning news sources, and you'll see one that says Russia is winning and another that says Ukraine is winning. And I just want to remind everybody, you know, the reason beyond Ukraine and the interests of the people of that country, and the Zelensky story, I think, captured people's imagination in such a strong way because he's just this feisty, you know, former comedian, then president of Ukraine, fighter who simply would not give up and was just an incredible inspiration, I think, to people in Ukraine and people around the world. But the big fear on the part of the United States and our European allies was that this would just be the beginning, that he was going to keep going, that there was an effort to reconstruct, you know, perhaps the Soviet Union, some would say the Russian Empire, sort of along those lines in terms of a nationalist, you know, Russian manifest destiny that was Putin's desire. So big picture, right, when you look at all of that, is that still the goal, do you think, of Putin? And are there signs, I was reading this morning about Lithuania, are there signs that he could continue to gobble up places that used to be part of the former Soviet Union?
Well, I think there's no question that Vladimir Putin wants to try to wait out the West. He's banking on a winter, a very cold winter, when all of a sudden the sanctions aren't hurting Russia as much, but in fact are hurting the West even more, when people, Europeans, are already paying an astronomical price, as we are here in the United States, for gasoline. When it comes to, you know, heating oil, heating your house, people are Putin, there's no question, he's testing the Western resolve. You know, when it goes, talking about the war and where things stand, officials, people I talk to on the ground in Ukraine, they want to see Ukrainians rise up. They want to see partisans behind enemy lines, much like we saw during World War II, rise up. They do. Some officials I talk to say there are Russian soldiers walking around Russian-held territory like Kherson, that big city in southern Ukraine. They're walking around without body armor, and that should not happen. There should be an insurgency underway. The problem is the Ukrainians, they fled most of their territory, at least the fighting age males, when they retreated. That's solidly in Russian hands. When you ask where things stand, where things going, it does have the feel, certainly when you look at the weaponry being sent into Ukraine, thousands more 155 rounds, artillery rounds. You also have Claymore mines. I mean, we're talking about Vietnam level weaponry for very close in fighting. British intelligence is saying the Russians are using butterfly mines. I mean, these are very, this is not just, you know, an artillery war or a missile war, as maybe people keep reading about in the papers. This is very upfront. But what's going to happen in the fall, Martha? What's going to happen in October? While Americans are watching football games here, the foliage is going to disappear. And what happens, that means cover, concealment, that becomes a big issue. And certainly that officials I talked to say that's going to hurt the defenders even more. So if you're part of the Ukrainian forces and you're used to having you know, a canopy overhead, trees, bushes, protecting you from Russian forces, that's going to disappear. In terms of what the Russians have, what they're doing, I spoke to an American fighter, a former Marine, believe it or not, a former grunt one night, was telling me that he's fighting with the Ukrainians on the front lines, and every time they put a drone in the air, every four or five flights, that's getting shot down. So this narrative that Ukraine is winning is not accurate. I wouldn't say they're losing, but this war increasingly feels like a stalemate. And these front lines, just look at the weaponry we're now giving the Ukrainians. It certainly has the feel that people are digging in and that these lines are not moving significantly.
You know, I'm curious what you think about, you know, we literally took a breath between the exit from Afghanistan and a full throttled effort to supply weaponry and not boots on the ground, but U.S. assets to this battle in Ukraine. And now it looks like we could be doing that for a really long time. What is your assessment of, you know, the end of Afghanistan? We're looking at the 1 year anniversary of that, and whether or not it set the stage for an environment where Putin felt, you know, they're giving up on Afghanistan. Why should I worry about going into Ukraine?
Well, there certainly are a few parallels in terms of testing U.S. resolve. I mean, as of today, with the Biden administration giving another $1 billion in weaponry, that brings the total near close to $10 billion in weapons. That's a lot of money. However, when you think about the U.S. hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan and leading some $80 billion in weaponry to the Taliban, certainly the U.S. is not approaching that. And having been at the White House all weekend and seeing this massive spending bill pass and some $375 billion going to combat climate change, certainly when you look at close to $10 billion in weaponry, there's an argument to be made that the U.S. can afford that and can afford to help the Ukrainians. Because as you alluded to earlier, Martha, there is concern in Europe that, you know, Putin, would he stop in Ukraine if he was able to take over the country? Would he stop there? You have neighboring Moldova. You have, be questionable if Putin would try to take on the NATO alliance. But it's very significant as we speak on the anniversary of Russia invading Georgia in 2008. It's worth noting, Martha, that invasion happened 4 months after a NATO summit in 2008 in Bucharest, when NATO denied membership to both Georgia and Ukraine. What happened? Putin rolled in to take parts of Georgia 4 months later, and of course rolled into parts of Ukraine 6 years later in 2014 to take Crimea and parts of Donbass, which is where, there's significant fighting today.
You know, we're seeing a lot of reports on Zaporizhia and the nuclear facility there and concerns about what could happen. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. It is huge. It's enormous. There are about 15 different nuclear reactors scattered around Ukraine. They get a significant amount of their power from nuclear power, which is not as much as France, but it's no small thing. Anytime you talk about war and a nuclear power plant in the same sentence, that isn't good. And while this is not Chernobyl, I mean, 30 years have passed since that tragic accident. You know, these are more modern nuclear power plants. Certainly the reactor, the core, is protected by many feet of concrete. However, when you have, you know, storage facilities for spent fuel rods, you don't need to be a nuclear power expert to know that, you know, artillery rounds, small arms, that should not be going off and striking anywhere near a nuclear power plant. And then, again, tragically, you know, Russian forces control this plant. That's not good news for Ukraine. People that are operating the plant are doing it, with a gun to their head. So you've seen the IAEA, the nuclear watchdogs, speak out about this, say it's a potential catastrophe. Officials I spoke to, an aide to President Zelensky just a few days ago in Kyiv, was very alarmed by it. And of course, he mentioned Chernobyl and he was very animated by it. And certainly nobody in Ukraine wants to see any kind of nuclear accident. So far, we have not seen any radiation leaks. But who really wants to test that? You know, see rounds of artillery crashing into a nuclear power plant.
The Untold Story continues right after this. pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
What about Zelensky? There was that period in the beginning of this war where it felt like every time he, you know, put his head above ground and walked out in these really very strong, defiant videos where he would walk around the Capitol in Kyiv with his top lieutenants, and you would just be fearful that he was going to get taken out at any moment. Does it feel like the effort to do that, to replace his government, has cooled off?
It does, Martha. And having spent the past 3 weeks on the ground in Kyiv, there were times, with the exception of seeing soldiers and being part of a curfew and under martial law, everybody has to be inside by 11 p.m. There are times it actually doesn't even feel like a war on the ground. Kyiv is safely in Ukrainian hands. There are no Russian forces in the vicinity. The closest ones are hours north in Belarus. And even those forces there are don't seem to be in any position to launch any kind of invasion like we saw on February 24th. And we know how that turned out. It wasn't just the Ukrainian resistance, but it was actually the supply lines and the inept supply chain that caused Russia to have to withdrawal and retreat. They had old vehicles, old tanks. They were poorly maintained. But when you talk about Zelensky, certainly he's attained something of rock star status. He was on the cover of Vogue magazine. He has not just world leaders. Remember Boris Johnson's, what some called the boss walk through downtown Kyiv, that suddenly sparked, you know, everybody wanted it, from Nancy Pelosi to other world leaders. And now we're seeing Hollywood actors. You know, Jessica Chastain was just in Kyiv meeting with President Zelensky. So he has all this attention. However, curiously, he's made some moves that have not drawn a lot of I wouldn't say scrutiny, but certainly follow-up reporting. He fired his top prosecutor and the head of his security services. It'd be like President Biden firing Merrick Garland and his FBI director. Mm-hmm. And yet nobody quite knows why. Zelensky said that he did it because he didn't think they were going after Russian spies and operatives, which, by the way, is a big problem, Martha. Everybody I spoke to, it always came up. You'd ask somebody about Russian spies, thinking, oh, this will be a throwaway question. It'll get a mumble. Because, you know, here in the United States, people just do not talk about espionage a great deal. Over there, a different story. Everyone, I spoke to Vitaly Klitschko, former world heavyweight champion of the world, who's now the mayor of Kyiv, a great heavyweight boxer. He said that it's a huge problem, these Russian operatives. They're in cities throughout Ukraine. They're helping guide missiles to their target. I mean, sadly, because of the Russian ineptitude, they're not hitting many of the targets they want to hit, and they're hitting civilian areas, apartment complexes, of course. You know, the Russians don't use our GPS system, that blue dot in your iPhone, Google Maps that helps you, you know, navigate. The Russians don't use that. They have their own satellite constellation in space, and there's certainly some evidence to say that it doesn't work as well. But I digress. Going back to Zelensky, this problem of Russian infiltration of his government, of different towns, it's a problem. And there's a reason that he fired two of his top security officials. But there really hasn't been a lot of reporting about that, on how deep-seated this problem is. But whether it's Vitaly Klitschko, the mayor of Kyiv, to other mayors, to different officials. In fact, I was at one backgrounder with some aides to Zelensky. And at the very end, I just asked about, do you have a problem with Russian spies? I thought it would be, you know, one or two, you know, words. It was, you know, 15 minutes these guys were talking about the problem of infiltration. So that is something certainly to keep an eye on.
And that's an alternative for Russia, right? To losing, to taking casualties, to military conquest, to just, you know, sort of slowly change the government, to put people in place. We've seen them do it in other places, and to put in place a friendly leadership.
There's no question that it's a potential problem, but it is interesting. You just walk around Kyiv, how safe it does feel. I mean, there are certainly missile strikes in the area. One was about 30 minutes from downtown Kyiv, But it is incredible day in, day out when you, you know, about three quarters of the city is back. This is a city of 3.6 million, Martha. And the fact that, you know, the mayor told me, I said, how many have returned? He said about three quarters. So in some ways, it feels like life as usual. And it does make you think, are we working our way towards some kind of, you know, end of a Korean War situation, or you know, West Germany, East Germany, North Korea, South Korea, where there's going to reach a point where are these lines going to be drawn hard and fast, and there's going to be a pause, whether it's for the winter and a winter campaign, or, you know, will it be longer? But certainly that's something the Ukrainians don't want. And as we mentioned earlier, there's certainly a test of wills here. Who's going to wait who out? I mean, recall back in the American Revolution, not to turn this into the History Channel, but, you know, George Washington, as long as he had his army, the U.S. was not going to be defeated. You know, the British held Philadelphia, New York at various times. They held different cities. But the whole point of Washington's philosophy was to wait out the British, to outlast them, to weaken them. But he didn't need to confront them head-to-head too many times. Of course, that happened, culminated in victory at Yorktown with the help of the French and Rochambeau. But just maintaining that army, the U.S. was never going to be defeated. And I think that's certainly an analogy right now with Ukrainian forces. You know, they have not launched major offensives to recapture Russian-held territory. Maybe they don't have to. Maybe as we see these casualties pile up, I mean, the Pentagon's number three today just said the Russians have suffered up to 80,000 casualties. That's killed and wounded, by the way, but that's not nothing. I mean, 80,000 is a lot, but it does say a lot that if that's the case, the Russians are losing so much, why aren't the front lines changing? And sadly, we had a hint of it last month in Aspen when the CIA director, Bill Burns, said that, yes, the Russians have suffered enormous casualties, but so have the Ukrainians. He used the word significant and a little bit less than what the Russians have suffered.
Well, that's sort of what I was asking a moment ago when you talk about replacing governments. And, you know, Kyiv feels fairly secure, as you point out from your eyewitness experience there. But when you look at the areas that perhaps Russia always had its biggest eye on in the east of the country, and where you can lock in, you know, commerce avenues to the Black Sea and oil, grain, you know, all kinds of resources in those areas, do you think that they're in a situation where at some point, given the casualties on both sides, there could be a settlement along the lines of what Kissinger suggested?
I think there's no question there's going to be pressure at some point on the Zelensky government to settle, for the simple reason is this: how long is the West going to continue to supply Ukraine with weapons? And when I say the West, clearly that's mostly the United States. The U.S. has spent and committed three times more money than the entire European Union as a 27-nation body. That's not going to last forever. There's no question. However, you brought up Afghanistan. You certainly can look at the U.S. experience in Iraq. Certainly, 5 months, working on 6 months into a war, these are still the early stages. But, you know, the big wake-up call for our listeners is that this war is not over, and Ukraine is not winning. They're not losing. They're holding the line. But what the Russians have is volume. We just spoke about the casualty figures. But think about the size of Russia. Think about these Russian soldiers, many of them conscripts, many of them from, you know, southern Russia, from Siberia. They're not necessarily from Moscow or St. Petersburg. This is turning into a greater horror for Russia, as they found themselves in back in the 80s in Afghanistan, when they suffered 15,000 dead in a decade. And that's already happened in not even 6 months of war.
So last question before I let you go is just your thoughts quickly on China and Taiwan and the escalating tensions there. What are you seeing there?
Well, there's no question there's some parallels between Taiwan and Ukraine, and that is many lawmakers and military experts have made the case that if Ukraine had all the weapons ahead of time, would Putin still choose to invade? As a matter of debate, many would say probably not. And so when you look at the U.S. relationship with Taiwan, I think many people, certainly officials at the Pentagon, State Department, and the Biden administration, probably are looking at Taiwan to make sure that they have what they need to defend themselves, because the U.S. has pledged to come to Taiwan's defense. And if China were to launch any kind of invasion, even though officials don't think that's going to happen for a number of years, that could change quickly. And a couple of years from now is not that far off in the grand scheme of things. When you think of an island that's just sitting about 100 miles offshore of mainland China. Now, unlike Ukraine, the U.S. military has a big presence in the Pacific. You have a whole Marine division in Japan. You've got, warships based out of Yokosuka. You have the USS Ronald Reagan is in the Philippine Sea right now. But it's certainly it's a challenge, because, again, we're talking about Ukraine primarily right now. But if we are going to talk about China, many people, the Elbridge Colbys of the world, would say China is the biggest threat. Don't take your eye off the ball too much. Of course, there's others that say the United States should be able to handle both Russia and China. But it's a problem that the Chinese forces, as we've seen when they launch short-range ballistic missiles over the island of Taiwan, when they scramble now over 200 fighter jets in the past week since Nancy Pelosi's visit. And let's face it, the Chinese are also seeing a divided America. President Biden today wasn't exactly endorsing Pelosi's stop there in Taiwan. When they asked if it was a mistake to go, what do you say? You say, oh, that was her decision. It wasn't exactly, it wasn't exactly an endorsement. So that's probably not – Beijing will probably try to exploit that. But as the U.S. has seen – if allies aren't protected and there isn't that threat of force, that's when you see things like Ukraine happen. Why did Vladimir Putin go into Ukraine? Because he thought he could. If he didn't think he could go into Ukraine, he probably doesn't invade Ukraine. And there's certainly many, many hawks in not just the U.S. government, but in America, that want to make sure that the U.S. military is strong enough to make China think twice about making that invasion and that amphibious landing.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the United States bulking up Taiwan in this moment, given the tensions, to the extent that you'd probably need to dissuade China. And who could even say if there is a possibility that China could be dissuaded at all on that question, given their sort of intrinsic belief that it's part of their country. And I also think about the exercises, the military exercises that we watched taking place to the north of Ukraine right before they crossed the border and went in. So we never really know what the timing, we can sort of be logical about what the timing might seem like.
And those videos looked good, didn't they, Martha? Those Russian tanks going across the plains in Belarus, and it was like, whoa, they're coming. They're going to take over Ukraine in days. And that didn't happen. Next thing you know, it was supply chain issues. It was a total mess. So it does make you wonder. However, China, study look like they are a much more serious threat and foe than the Russians. One thing to point out, the U.S. doesn't even train with Taiwan. So in terms of just interoperability, that's something that they'd be starting from scratch. The U.S. has given, of course, a lot of weapons to Taiwan over in recent decades. But in terms of interoperability, fighting together, that just doesn't happen.
We did have some people in there at one point, right? And then
very small amount, though. Very small amount. Kind of, I would say token amount. Like when there's, a couple Green Berets doing some exercises on the beach, that's one thing. But in terms of doing any kind of, I'm talking about, squadrons training together, warships at sea, that stuff doesn't happen. Those major large scale exercises, let's look what the Chinese are doing. Like the U.S. does not do this kind of wargaming with Taiwan. And some would say that's a problem.
Lucas Tomlinson, always great to see you. Thank you very much for talking with us today. I know you weren't supposed to be working today, so we really appreciate
it. It's great.
Calling.
We could
have
gone on for another 30 minutes.
Yeah, I know. Well, we like to have these conversations, so I like it when we can share it with everybody else as
well.
Oh, yeah.
No. I mean, listen, it's all fascinating and really great talk. And I love the format because it's like we're sitting at a restaurant or a bar just
exactly.
letting it go.
Thanks so much, Lucas.
Awesome, Martha.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Okay.
Lucas
Bye-bye.
Tomlinson joining the Untold Story. We'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.